Hi, Gemma. Hi, Jimmy. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Morning.
Good morning. And hey, Carrie.
Hello.
Glad to be co-interviewing with you again.
Exactly.
I don't know who wants to take the lead first, but maybe give a little bit of a quick introduction about yourselves. I'm happy to be discovering both of you in this interview, and so I'd like to hear kind of maybe where you're from, something that you find so important to say to people to get so that they can get a good idea about you. Mm. What's your favorite food?
Impossible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So who wants to go first?
Hi, I'm Jimmy Tran. I hail from Houston, Texas. And I had like a really unusual path through life, but now I'm like a cook, designer type person. So, yeah. And I don't really believe in like favorite foods or anything like that. But right now I'm really into Northern Thai cuisine.
That is a big statement.
Yeah. But yeah, Jem and I went to Thailand together, and so ever since then it's been really important for us to connect on that way. But yeah. Wow.
And I grew up just a few blocks from where we're sitting right now in Lower Manhattan. Also don't really believe in favorite food. Food is like color, like the seasons. It just shifts all the time. But I'm a podcast producer, and I produce radio and podcast events also. So always kind of like off mic, putting people in front of mic. So this is interesting turnaround. And also an artist, and I make audio art works. And then together, Jimmy and I make a lot of food projects that intersect with conversation and narrative. And that's kind of the genesis of Cosmophage. We call it narrative gastronomy. It's a kind of idea that we've coined that blends our backgrounds in storytelling and in cuisine together.
Mm-hmm. And what does that, just to jump right in, because I'm seeing all sorts of things coming together right in front of me, because I mean, we would have loved to have hosted Cosmophage a little bit longer today, because they suggested some really wonderful things that were along the line of what you were just talking about. We were going to have bring sounds of Chinatown in here. We were going to bring foods of Chinatown in here. That's something we'd still like to do, but that makes, you know, a lot of sense. But what format does that usually take? How do you host people at, you know, your own personal space? Do you show in galleries? Do you perform? What kind of space are you working in with Cosmophage?
Yeah, no two alike at this point. Mm-hmm. We've done events outdoors, private homes. I guess those have been the predominant options.
Yeah, and in performances as well. Mm-hmm. And we're working on some art objects and other things and looking for galleries to show that work in. But I think all the things you talked about, anything that deals with food, we take and turn into some form, and we present it in some way that's challenging the way that people have a relationship with their own food. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to us. I think food design is one way of thinking about it, but maybe like critical food design is something that's more accurate. But
I guess I was curious how you tailor your events to different types of audiences, and how much you know about your audience before you put on the events themselves, or if you really see the events as the place where you're kind of like learning from each other, or if it's a kind of one directional thing where you're kind of like presenting something and people are learning from you.
Mm-hmm. Well, specifically, we did an event in June called the Dinner of Intimacy that was kind of part performance, and it was a love story that was articulated through food. And so there were kind of two audiences, or an audience within an audience. We had these diners that were like diner actors feeding one another, and then people around them watching. And in that sense, the whole menu was and designed around the creating new ways for people to feed one another that would articulate specific sentiments. And so it was very much designed with the audience in mind. And then the people that were watching had to kind of were we found out later, very much like projecting themselves into the diners as they were kind of like one degree of separation, experiencing the food from afar.
Yeah. It seemed like just from looking at the event online, like the documentation of it that you had, it seemed very kind of cinematographic, like where you're sitting and you're watching the whole thing kind of unfold. And yeah, that kind of projecting of yourself into someone else seemed like to be a really big part of that. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Yeah, something we talk about a lot is that food is a medium. It's an artistic medium for us, and that we want to convey a large body of emotion and thought and philosophy through food. And so typically our events don't use a table. They don't have like a dinner service. We don't bring bread and then an appetizer out. It's kind of responding to a body of research and emotion, and then what's the most interesting and compelling way that we can translate that so that people can consume it.
Cool. Yeah.
To what extent is the work, how do I phrase this? If I were to close my eyes and sit in the space and take in with my ears what's coming in and eat at the same time, would that be your artwork? Are those two things, is that how you experience your...
Are you saying work? Only through taste?
Taste like and kind hearing. Of like it's, I'm just thinking, like, because there's such a thing as kind of performing with food. And I mean, the things that I think of are like, you know, these films that the cook, the wife, the thief, and her lover, or what? Do you know that film?
No.
And they have these endless. You guys should watch it. It's incredible. Endless long shots through a kitchen, and all these kind of social dynamics that are going on, and they're all busy with food somehow. And then you go to this dinner table setting in the middle of this very saturated restaurant saturated in color, and you know all these different characters are feeding each other, and you can tell the dynamics by what they're doing with food and the types of food that are in front of them are changing. And is it something you as an audience you look at and experience in that way, or is it very much about what you're tasting? And
I think like The problem with like dealing with food is people compare it to like restaurants in a way, and catering in general. And I think the problem with that is people, the general conception is that food is to be tasted and that's about it. Mm-hmm. And when you go to restaurants, I think like people really understand at a high level that hospitality and that type of emotion you get from that experience is almost as important as the flavor of the food itself.
Right.
And so that's kind of what we want to do with our studio. It's like elicit emotions and feelings and communicate certain ideas and have experiences come through that rather than just through the taste of the food itself.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's good to know.
So it's very like multi-sensory. It's not just about like, cause I've looked at the documentation of some of your events and it's beautifully like done and everything's like really gorgeous. And I can imagine the pleasure of that event is partially the taste because it seems like you're putting together some really amazing foods, but also the presentation and just the kind of atmosphere and the setting. And I guess as an architect, I'm curious, like, how much of the environment are you in control of? How much do you want to be in control of? Like, what types of things go into setting up that environment?
Mm-hmm.
It's like we want to control everything and nothing, I think, in the sense that, like, we talk a lot about interaction and about, you know, what can you do to create, you can sort of guide or orchestrate a certain level of like how much people are engaging with one another and engaging with the food, and then kind of like the beautiful chaos of like what actually happens when people are interacting with your artwork. I mean, that's kind of all art. You never know what is going to actually happen when someone brings their own body of experience, their own background to tasting or feeling your work. But you look like you were going to jump in, Jimmy.
Oh, I just, yeah, I think Gemma and I both really care about like authorship and like just being able to control every element as much as possible, lighting, furniture, like objects, everything you touch and feel.
Scent.
Yeah, everything. We're just totally interested in all these like facets of the world and try to bring some, use that in some way to create an experience for other people.
We had someone say, asked after the dinner of intimacy, like it was a complete act, in a sense, like from even, you know, we designed signage up the staircase, and there was like a moment in the bathroom so that you never left the experience of like being inside this performance. And that's exciting to us to kind of create a whole creature out of an idea.
It's the term in opera, the term is Gesamte Kunstwerk. It's like, yeah, their theater, yeah. All for that.
Well, I think it's also important just for you as a collective as well, right? Because you've got to somehow document what it is that you've done. And like if it's just the food, once it's gone, it's gone. And there's no way to really kind of like convey that sense. So by having a little bit more control or just kind of like thought into what, how the food is, like the environment of the food, then you actually have something to kind of like, you have documentation of it and a way to talk about it outside of just the event itself. It's pretty cool.
So what are your backgrounds, and how much of that have you, do you bring into your artwork, and how much do you dedicate time to go out and explore? And I mean, I guess that's two questions, but maybe let's start with the background one.
Definitely. I mean, I think that all the work that we make together is very much just like a flow of ourselves, and also the like unique, strange thing that is our collaboration. My background is in storytelling. I've worked at organizations from StoryCorps to Public Radio International. I was a producer for many years at The Moth, and now I produce On Air Fest, which is a podcast and audio festival here in New York at White Hotel. And so all of my work has been about audio storytelling and what happens when people are sharing their backgrounds and experiences.
How did you get into that? Is that something that, as a, when you were growing up, that you were drawn to storytelling? Were you a radio nut? Were you?
I was a history kid.
You're a history
kid.
Yeah. Okay.
But I wanted to talk to people and see if there was a way to talk to people for a living. And so I started doing a bunch of oral histories when I was in college. And then a friend was like, oh, this is called journalism. There's a word for it. Because I went to a small liberal arts school where that wasn't a program. But I've always had a very like tactile art practice. Jimmy and I both sew, we both make our own clothes, and then cooking is a way to like step back from the computer and do something that's like physical and embodied instead of just like digital life around the clock.
Right.
And both your parents are artists, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
they are.
I love Gemma's background, so charmed compared to my own. You know, it's New York like native, and like grew up with like all the, around all these artists, go to gallery shows all the time, and I think it's really cool.
Yeah, my dad's a cartoonist and a photographer and street art documenter, and my mom's an animator.
Wow.
So kind of a, I don't know, a good mix.
That's a fun household, yeah.
Yeah. I think for myself, I've always been interested in design. I started off doing like web design as a kid on GeoCities and like doing like websites for like friends and companies, and that's always been fun. I always like fancied myself a graphic designer, but really I found that I'm not really that good at it. But then I went to school for architecture, and that's why like every time I meet an architect, I super gush over like what they do because I think it's super cool. But I just have this like Renaissance idea of like what architects are. You have to be like a really prominent like painter and like mathematician and philosopher and like musician and all this stuff to be like an architect. And I always looked up to that in a way. So I always just like thought of my life as do everything that's like really interesting, and then like somehow that becomes something. And I think architecture is that for a lot of people, and for me it's just like I believe in this anti-disciplinary way of like living life, just like do things that are interesting to you, and somehow something interesting and new will come up. People like kind of follow these paths of life where you have to do these particular things for a while, and then you become like this specialized person in this discipline. I find you just create the same work as everybody else. So I like this idea of just like doing a bunch of things that I'm passionate about, and then somehow it comes together in the way it has. So like I started off going to school for architecture and like took this default path, and then after a while I started doing really weird stuff. I started cooking, which is like a little unusual for architecture, and then after that I worked at a design studio here in Brooklyn. and just came up from there. So I've had this really lucky life where weird opportunities have presented themselves to me, and I just say, yeah, I'll do it. And then I just end up in that industry for a really long time.
Yeah. So you worked in kitchens. You worked as a chef for... And this was restaurants here, or this what kind of projects were these or organizations?
So I started cooking in a restaurant in Texas where I went to school, Texas A&M, and after that I went to a culinary apprenticeship in West Virginia called the Greenbrier, and it's like kind of like a finishing school for like CIA students, kind of like Culinary Institute of America, not Central Intelligence Agency. But yeah, so I just went there, and I spent 3 years doing an apprenticeship. And then I cooked for 2 more years after that in professional kitchens in San Francisco, in Houston, and in New York here.
I'm just going to break in and say that Jimmy's stories from the Greenbrier blow my mind. Like, in terms of what you think's going to happen to you at culinary school, it's, like, so much more extreme. I mean, it's 16-hour days. Mm. Like, all you do is cook, but very rigorously.
Yeah. I think the thing that's interesting about that is, like, you don't just go to culinary school and, like, go to classes the way that people think of culinary school. You work a 12-hour shift, and then 4 hours after that, you do, like, this, like, coursework where you do, like, you just practice your craft and do more things. You're, like, spending time in the butcher shop or, like, making up dishes and doing menu development. So
seems reasonable. Yeah. Like, you work with knives after a 12-hour shift.
Yeah, really safe. Yeah.
And never miss again.
Yeah. And I've really learned a lot from that, in that, like, I can operate so well without sleep. And I don't think that's, like, a really important thing to be able to do.
I don't think that was where you were going. Oh,
yeah. Explains the architecture.
Oh, proud. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I didn't stay an architect, or at least.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think that's an important thing. I think sleep's super important, yeah. And there's a lot of studies on
IQ. Shout out to sleep.
Yeah.
Shout out to sleep, yeah.
But yeah, I found, like, levels of myself and limits I can push, and finding my boundaries and going past that in cooking, and just, like, being able to manage my time in a really interesting way. So, yeah. What stories are you talking about?
I don't know. There's, like, that...
Yeah, I want to hear some stories.
There's that story about the guy who put his hand in the deep fryer.
Oh, yeah. It's, like, the most interesting story of all time. Like, this guy is, like, the ballsiest dude I've ever met. He, like, I think somebody threw a lighter to him because he wanted to go out and smoke, and he missed and threw it into the deep fryer. And everybody's like, oh, my God, this whole place is going to explode. It's fucking insane. And so we all... So everybody's, like, running out, and this guy's like, I got this. And he dunks his hand in, like, ice water for, like, 10 seconds, and then dunks his hand into the deep fryer, pulls the lighter out, and, like, holds it above his head, and everybody's just like, ah, what are you doing? This guy's crazy. And he's, like, saved the world, you know? Like, this restaurant could have been in fire. It's, like, incredible.
Wait, the ice bucket to deep fryer trick worked?
Yeah, it totally works.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good to know.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Put that one on your list.
Right. That's a great story, because I thought you were talking about the other stories where, like, I used to be a monster in a kitchen, you know? Like, people think of me as, like, this super nice person, but I used to, like, pour sauces on people and, like, do crazy stuff, throw plates. And I found that working in kitchens, like, kind of turned into a terrible person in some ways if you're a leader. So
yeah.
I've kind of, like, left kitchens for that reason, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oof. Take it there.
Yeah.
No, but I do think there is, like, a certain culture of, like, a part of the culinary world that exists, and it's known to, like, draw out a certain kind of, like, intensity, and that's why we're not working in kitchens now.
That's changing a lot. I think there's a lot of, like, health insurance and a lot of nice benefits of working in kitchens these days, and it used to be that way, and I think it's a lot better now. Mm-hmm. But I think it really does work, and I think the problem with kitchens is, like, you have to lead by fear, and that's kind of, like, the most effective way to lead a team of people that work on tight timelines and all these things. But I'm so glad to hear that there's a lot of people that are able to lead by example and, like, have really healthy ways of leading people. And so I value kitchens now a lot more than I did before. Yeah.
What was the second half of your question?
God, I forgot.
Well, I'm curious how you two met. Like, you had these kind of, like, very multidisciplinary or anti-disciplinary backgrounds, and then how did you meet?
We met very circuitously.
I love this story, by the way.
Like, I think I have to take it back. I was at a bar.
As all good stories go.
And I wasn't drinking, and I saw someone else who wasn't drinking, and we struck up a conversation. We were talking about, like, Murakami, and he was reading A Wild Sheep Chase, And I was like, I have a friend who has a sheep farm. We should go meet the sheep together. And then like a month later, I got a text and he was like, I'm ready to meet these sheep. And we ended up...
This is not me. This is not me, by the way.
Yeah, oh, but okay. We have to... The backstory is good, so we got to go there. Yeah. And then we like drove up to Vermont together. We hugged a sheep in the rain. We like cried. Oh. And then his name is Tag. And then Tag knew Jimmy because they'd met each other on the street in Bushwick.
At Bushwick Open Studios.
Bushwick Open Studios. Mm-hmm. And then they had an idea for collaboration. You jump in.
Yeah, and so he and I thought it'd be really cool to start a horchata company. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to create food products. But then he was like, it's going to be called Rice and Beans because it's horchata plus espresso. And I was like, okay, I'm in. I'm totally in. This is the greatest idea. So he and I started doing that. And to do the market research, we were like, we should just try all the horchata in New York. And I was like, I don't know where any horchata is. And he's like, I know somebody that does know. And so we go to Sunset Park, and that's when I meet Gemma and her partner at the time. And we took this like walking tour of Sunset Park and drank like eight gallons of horchata.
Oh
and
God. Really we did like it. Horchata flight mm-hmm. all yeah. the way down Fifth Ave in Sunset Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then that just like sealed the deal.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Friends ever since. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember the second half of the question, and that is. You mentioned traveling to Thailand together. Mm-hmm. How much is that a part of your work to go out and seek adventure to take in new tastes, new horchata adventures in Sunset Park and and Thailand? How does that?
I think all of our work is about research and going out and eating together. I think any chance I go out to do anything, I'm researching. So I go to a restaurant, I order like way too much. Mm-hmm. And I really just like try to learn from it.
Oh, totally. I mean, so when we went to Thailand, my mom at the time was teaching in Yangon in Myanmar. And so we went to Thailand and we went to Myanmar together. And my mom, ever since, is just like, oh, I only like to eat out with Jimmy because he orders the entire menu and then he'll finish the entire menu. But it's like, I think trying foods and then also just seeing, like, the total experience, whether it's, like, a gordita, like, truck on the street or, like, a nicer restaurant, it's always, like, what is the experience of, like, of eating in its totality is mm-hmm. a big part of our research.
Yeah.
Text write-offs all over the place.
Yeah.
How often do you go to new places in New York? Like, how much is that a part of your...
I go at least, like, 3 times a week.
To a new place.
Yeah. I mean, 50% of my, like, consumption is cooking for myself to practice, and then 50% just eating out to see what everybody else is doing all the time. But Gemma, I go out to eat at least like once every 2 weeks, one time a week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 And it'll always be a new place or you?
I mean, I think right now the count is there's like 25,000 restaurants or places to eat in New York. And so I think if you eat one meal a day, at each restaurant, it takes like 22 years for you to eat at every restaurant in New York. So I think I'm pretty okay.
Yeah, I think the only place we go back to is the Gordita truck in Sunset. God. That's like the only like repeat hit.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
47th Street and 5th Avenue. Mm-hmm. It's really something special.
Shout out.
Yeah.
Wow, that's I'm embarrassed to say I find it hard to like think of on the spot think of new places to go, but you know, I mean, the best thing to do, I guess, is just to start walking on a street and see where that takes you. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I'm sure you have an unbelievable amount of tips. Just follow right behind you. Mm.
How much experimenting do you end up doing at home? And do you cook together or is it a separate experience and you kind of like come together and like, oh, I tried this out. Let's see how they can work together on a menu or like, you know, and I say menu in quotes because obviously it's not really a menu, but... Mm-hmm. Pairing things.
Yeah. I think Gemma and I have kind of different backgrounds in cooking, and I'm like very wary to cook around other people because I feel like I'm going to be a really mean person.
The monster.
Yeah. The monster
might come out.
I'm really working on it, really.
Wow.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just sometimes I'll just say, like, you know, you could say a mean thing or you could teach me.
And I'm really like happy to have Gemma as part of this thing, because I feel like I would just, if I worked with other cooks and chefs, like, yeah, it totally makes sense to act this way, and it's just like a known language that you speak. But when you deal with other people, you have to like understand where they come from and their context. Yeah. And so I think it's really a happy coincidence that Gemma has a love for food, but doesn't come from a kitchen background.
Yeah. I cooked at one restaurant briefly, but it was not like culinary in the same regard. But I think that we both respect each other's like way that we approach flavor and how we identify foods and experience them. So there's like a shared respect or a mutuality there. But jumping into your question a bit, like the process of us designing menus together has been really interesting and bewildering because I don't have as much experience with menu design, but something that's been really fun, I think, is like how our different backgrounds are operating together. So an example of that being for the Dinner of Intimacy, we wanted to articulate basically the experience of love or a relationship across five different courses. So from the encounter and meeting one another to like the rhythmic layering of like a relationship that is more codified to the just excruciating frustration of like knowing someone too well and starting to like lose trust in the relationship.
What were the courses? Can you tell us that? Or
sure,
what
yeah.
the foods were?
Yeah, they, well, I guess how
or
we got
how,
there.
How you got there. Mm-hmm.
Was I wrote almost these kind of essays or short stories for each course, and Jimmy told me, don't think about ingredients, don't think about what is known, because we're going to invent flavors, mm-hmm. like new flavors for each of these ideas.
And forms, yeah.
And forms. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, the second course was kind of the idea of, as you get to know someone, you start to tell them, and in a sense yourself, a new story about who you are in the context of this new relationship. I think it's something that we've all experienced before. And so we wanted to find a way to embody that. Mm-hmm. And so what we created were a bunch of different foods that were pink and a bunch of different foods that were green. And I'll let you kind of jump in and identify some of those. Mm-hmm. And had a series of questions that the diners would ask one another. And when they got an answer, they would put either a yes green food or a no pink food on each other's hands and create what we thought mm-hmm. of as like a narrative bite mm-hmm. of the other person's story. And then they were asked to consume each other's stories directly off of their hands.
Oh.
But some of the pink foods, I remember candied pink peppercorns, mm-hmm. There's
like a beet cured fluke, and there's some crackers and other things in there. Some, I think rhubarb was one of them maybe. But I think the thing was like each of the questions like kind of identify what the food product would be for the yes or no question. So like the meatier kind of like bigger questions like were a protein, and the kind of the smaller kind of like garnish of a question or idea that you have to present to somebody is mm-hmm. a garnish, an accoutrement in that dish. So there are powders and sauces and meats and vegetables and proteins, and you kind of create this composed dish that you put on your hand and like present to somebody else. So you're presenting your story to somebody else in that way.
And then you had to like lick it right out of their hand, and it was like messy and sexy and ridiculous.
But the first course I really loved, I think the encounters, I kind of imagined how you, like when you first like make out with somebody, like when you're kissing somebody, it's like mm-hmm. this interaction that you have where you're like, you feel it, but also you're like trying to understand what they're feeling, and you have like this like ongoing back and forth. And so for that course, we came up with the idea of five different spheres that all look pretty similar, but you don't know what they are, and you feed it to one another in different ways. So like, somebody's feeding you a sphere, and you don't know what you're eating, but you're eating it, and you're tasting it, and then you're also imagining what it's like for them to taste it and feel it as well. So a lot of those courses were just like, you know, white chocolate shells with like corn puree on the inside, and a lot of these flavors came from Gemma's background and her relationship. So things that like happened or they ate together during that time, I kind of like repurposed and reused to put in each of the ingredients. But I think the form and the delivery of it was like the funnest part for me. during that whole process. Yeah.
I love, there was a, I was, one of the favorite things I remember was the, you made a paper out of dehydrated fennel stalks and made that, cut that into ribbons and tied some of the spheres with fennel stalk ribbons.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it sounds really, really pretty. I just like can't help but think about what you would do for like as a, an event for a bunch of like 5-year-olds or something. I think that would be like so much fun. I recently was visiting some friends in Los Angeles that have a 6-month-old baby, and they were just starting to feed the baby solids because it had only been drinking milk for the last 6 months. And at this point, it's not about actual nutrition. It's about motor skills and like getting food into your mouth and that kind of stuff. But it was just amazing to watch her put a new food into her mouth that she had never tasted before. And look, I mean, she, most of the time, her, the look on her face was just like absolutely horrified. She was like, what is this thing? But, you know, she would kind of keep going at it and then eventually would like eat a whole little round of sweet potato or something like that. But I just feel like there's like such a kind of similarity between I mean this in the nicest way possible, but between this like 6-month-old trying foods for the first time and like understanding what food is and like a menu or a, an event that you might create.
I don't know what you're thinking, Jimmy, but I'm immediately like, how can we make people eat like babies, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah. I think that's what we kind of do. It's like people have to rediscover what food is, could be. And I think that's what's really important about what we do. It's just like challenging your perception of like the food that you eat. Like you could get stuck just like eating hummus all day and like eat avocado toast.
Ouch, but you just like read into my...
I'm like staring at your eyes as I say this. Like, but yeah, and so like what's a new way to consider food? And I think this is like a bigger like issue. It's like avocados and like almonds are like taking over California and like taking up all the water. And it's like because people eat the same things. And so
we
like,
monocrop ourselves.
Yeah. So like how do we diversify the way that we eat and like make people interested in new things and new experiences?
Yeah. Well, when Lin Yi was here last week, I was listening to the interview and she said something about, you know, the interesting thing about working in the medium of food is that, you know, we all have to eat, right? And it just like, but we all eat so differently, and how we eat is like tied to so many different things, cultural, socioeconomic. And so I think it's like such an interesting medium to be working in, and like really thinking about those layered things about monocropping and that kind of stuff. Like how do we change that, but at the same time, how do we like make it more accessible and those types of things?
Food is incredibly political. I mean, they're just what we think is healthy, what we think is good for our bodies or good for our spirits. Even how we celebrate with food is so specific to culture on every level.
Yeah, I've been really lucky just to like find myself in food because I've been so interested in a lot of other things, but food touches everything, like politics, culture, sciences, so many parts that you can get into with just through the entryway of food that I really love.
And just to ask, to focus on you a little bit, Gemma, you mentioned that sound is a big part of all of this.
Yeah.
We haven't spoken about that yet. I'm really curious as to what that is.
Yeah, how you just cracked open a peanut and ate it, like, and I could hear it crinkling in the background. Yeah. It was amazing.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was great.
Well, Gemma surprised me when she said she didn't want to eat on the air. I thought, wow. Do you think you can brave a peanut?
I could brave a peanut for sure. I'll do whatever. But I guess I said I didn't
want to like half cracked open. But
I said I didn't want to eat on air just because there's always those like, you know, that it's like a really, it's a great sound, but it's a really specific sound.
What is it, ASMR? Is that what? Yeah. I'm sure we could be fulfilling someone's deepest desires.
Yeah, peanut cracking. Sensuality fetishes. We're just weeding out the weak listeners.
Take it there. These are good. What are they flavored with?
They have a bit of anise in them.
They're from around the corner. We discovered Chinese peanuts, and we've been eating a bag a day in the office.
Yeah. I have a really soft spot for boiled peanuts, especially.
Are these boiled?
No, but you know, sometimes you can find those around here too. Nice though. I really.
Yeah.
What do you think? No, I think, like, this is literally, this is what we'll do, like, sit with something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it makes me salivate a lot. Really savory.
They're also very salty, so there's probably...
Yeah. It could be saltier.
Yeah, or salt fiends.
I think it has a really, like, surprising crunch. Mm-hmm. I was expecting something a bit softer.
Yeah, they're roasted. Yeah, they're, like, softer than I thought they were going to be. I think they're going to be, like really crackly, crunchy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like how the anise has kind of, like, gotten through the skin and is in the peanut itself. It's not just, like, a flavor.
I did an experiment yesterday. Yeah. I was like, is it in the shell or is it in the peanut itself? So I removed them from each other and I tried it and it is in the peanut.
I wonder if it was soaked.
It must be soaked because that's why the texture is the way it is. Yeah. You know? But star anise, right?
Star anise. Just soaked in star anise. Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Nice.
Sound. Yeah. So I'm working on a project currently about scent memory. I just came back from a residency in Lima last month where I was editing a body of interviews that I've been recording that are people's stories of specific odors. Let's see. I should have a really good way of describing this. But not just that, you know, when you eat a peanut, it reminds you of 34 East Broadway, but a specific...
It will after this. This is over.
But a specific instance and a feeling, mm-hmm. Because scent is so evocative and triggers such intense memories. I conducted a series of interviews kind of capturing those memories, and the final stage of this process that I'm building out right now is creating an installation where people will be able to listen to the stories and breathe the scent at the same time. And like a lot of the projects that I work on both independently and with Jimmy, the kind of question or the provocation in mind is how close can you get? How intimately can you understand someone else's experience or memory? And mm-hmm. both taste and smell are really interesting pathways to intimacy.
So what you just did with in terms of analysis of the peanut, mm-hmm. how do you do that with someone? How do you dig in and reach that point? And that might be an industry secret, but
I don't believe in industry secrets in regards to radio technique or interview, because mm-hmm. I think that this should just be like publicly accessible information. But honestly, it just comes from doing a lot of interviews. It's mm-hmm. really a kind of, I think, a similar muscle to cooking, where there's just like you can go really deeply, but you have to try it out. I mean, the first few years that I was interviewing people, I had no idea how to access in that way. But with these interviews in particular, a lot of what I would do with the folks I was talking to was, after we'd landed on a specific story, talk very environmentally for a while. So before we even got to any sort of questions that would frame the narrative, it would be talking about, what does the floor feel like underneath your feet? What is the quality of light? Look left, what do you see? Look right, what do you see? And creating like a body of environmental descriptions so that they were very present.
And you also give them some tools that they can lean on to, like, mm-hmm. hey, remember, you can describe things in this way and you mm-hmm. can describe things in that way.
And then also guiding them towards speaking in the present tense. So it was almost like memory entry in that way. Like, mm-hmm. I'm sitting down, I'm in front of three friends, there's a bowl of peanuts in front of me, and when I bite into one with my front teeth, I hear a crack, like that kind of speech pattern.
And what is the, is there a way that these are going to be incorporated into, I mean, that you're a collective, is this going to be incorporated together, is this going to be brought together? I mean, I know that you said you're bringing sense into it.
This one, I mean
are these separate
works, but I mean, we, like, I bring all the things that I'm working on to Jimmy and vice versa, mm-hmm. and we've talked a lot about perfume, and we've gone to different, you know, perfume stores and asked a zillion questions and tried to, like, understand what's happening, and we're actually working on a separate project right now that doesn't have to do with scent, but also memory and the construction of memory in a kind of circuitous way. Maybe you want to talk a bit about the project we have in the works.
Talk about reification.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I find that there's like a lot of gaps in the English language. I love the English language. I really care about writing and all these other things, but I feel like I think the best way to explain this is like how I think about relationships, right? I think there's like this default way of like thinking about how you can be with another person, and it's like either you're friends with benefits, you're like in a relationship heading toward marriage, but there's really no in between. I think it's okay to like be in a relationship with somebody where you like are okay with like no future and other things like that. And there's a lot of gaps there. There's like a gradient that's going on. And so Jem and I were really intrigued by this word hygge, this like Danish word for like comfiness and like coziness. And it's like that's a word that exists in another culture, but it doesn't exist here. And it's kind of like other words like terroir, you know, like the idea of like everything comes from this land. And
you described one earlier, Bella, Gesamt.
Gesamtkunstwerk. That's an all-embodying artwork.
Yeah.
So. And there's like no real like single word or like phrase for that in English, I guess.
My favorite. I'm Dutch, and my favorite Dutch word is gezellig, which is not super easy on the ears, but the meaning of it. It's my favorite word because it embodies coziness, comfort, a feeling of home. But you also use it if you've had a nice dinner with friends and you describe it, you can use that word to describe a kind of familiarity or fun, or it just has a, it's more like you recognize the immediate feeling that you have with that word rather than it being a particular like descriptive thing.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Wait, can I hear it again?
Gezellig.
Nice. And so I think there's a lot of like human emotion and feeling and like these like things that we all experience together. And it's like, how come there's not a word for that? And how come there's like, I think in a way, it's, without having a word, there's like no precedence for it, right? And so it becomes less known in our lives. So I think Jem and I thought like, it'd be really interesting to capture these emotions, like describe them, and then make up a word for them so that we can then push it out into our culture, and then now it becomes a real thing. And so we're working on this project now where we have thought about emotions and feelings and experiences that other humans have had, but there's no word in our English language to capture them and to communicate them to other people. And then from there, we take those words and turn them to experiences and perhaps food as well.
So we're creating a whole new lexicon of invented words, and then each word is going to have an accompanying like food item or dish, and so we're creating in a sense a series of edible mnemonic devices as well, so that people can remember those words and start to use them, and we're doing this like with a collaborator, Q, who's not here today also, but just wanted to
shout out
Q. And kind of, it's really interesting to, we've been doing a lot of research into words that exist in other languages. We haven't come across Hazela yet.
Hazela.
But
I'll write it down for you.
Yeah. It was really lovely to like look to, I mean, languages from all over the world and be like, oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
What was that Italian one? Okay, I'm not going to remember the word itself, but it was like the word for like trying to capture, like, reinitiate a relationship that's like very, very dead. And like,
it's the word for like boiled cabbage, right?
Yes. Old and it literally translates to like boiled boiled cabbage. And I was like, word, that's so good.
It's so
good.
That's amazing.
My favorite, that's because I don't know Italian very well, but everybody in Italy says echo all the time. And I love that everybody's saying echo to each other.
Yeah. In Greek, like it's Ella.
Ella?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's like cool. It's like Ella.
Or echo.
Yeah. It's very...
Yeah. Pleasant. I like that you can make sounds to acknowledge somebody or something, and it doesn't have to necessarily mean something. It's just comforting to have a response.
It was really interesting thinking about the creation of these words too, because between the three of us, we speak several different languages, but didn't want to necessarily create words that immediately resonated as being like X language. So just working through all the body of like sounds that our tongues could make, and then what they make us feel, and trying to come up with words that would somehow embody or resonate with those feelings made us just like sit around the table being like,
a new Esperanto.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting too, because like you're, when you eat different types of foods, your mouth makes different, you know, I'm thinking of like slurping noodles versus like eating salad or something like that. Like it's just totally different, like mouth feels and like all that kind of stuff too. So that's
cool.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of sounds like you already are doing this, but do you have a dream project or a kind of dream audience or anything like that?
I think that I would try to make every project that I'm working on the dream project. I'm not waiting for the dream project to emerge in the same way. And we've talked about this. Like, I don't think there's a job that is creative. I think a person is creative. And every project is such a learning experience that, like, that's the dream.
Yeah. It's true, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of the, like, I mean, the difference between like a design practice and an art practice is, you know, designers have to wait for a client to come along, and an art practice, you can kind of like just experiment as you need to. And I think, Jimmy, that maybe that speaks a little bit to what you were talking about, this kind of like anti-disciplinary and just like just wanting to do what you need to do in order to express an idea rather than waiting around for someone to come and hire you to do it.
Yeah, I mean, money is super important, and like having somebody with tons of money so we can do big projects and do them in the way that we think is right is really helpful. But I think just any time we have anybody that's interested and passionate about our work and wants to collaborate in some way, that's like always really interesting to us. And to find some way to, it's like a design problem always. And so it's like, how can we come up with the coolest, most interesting thing given all the constraints, and how can we do that together in a fun, interesting way?
Yeah. And we never work alone. Every project that we've worked on, like we're a very flexible collective, has had like different set of collaborators too. So there's always like different influences coming in that we're responding to. And I mean, other people's backgrounds and expectations and fears and, you know, thrills are part of the process too.
So two kind of closing questions that we like to pass through at least at one point in the interview, because our reach is here, this wonderful community in Chinatown. And if there were any kids listening, what are sort of bits that you'd like to point out in terms of what it takes to make those, you know, what were important moments where you decided, okay, now I can start on my own, and now I feel like I have, I don't know, maybe a breadth of knowledge or maybe a certain confidence, or what is something that, that has allowed you to make the decision to work, to do the things that you want to do and make a living out of it?
I think there's so much learning through the doing, and but in that sense of like waiting for the dream project, I can get really intimidated by the idea of like the perfect piece or the final project, final piece. And so everything that I do, I want to do it to the utmost extent, but I think it's important to think of work as iterative also. And I remember when I started on an independent audio project many years ago when I was living in Minneapolis, my boss at the time was like, you should stage it in your living room with friends. And I had like much grander ambitions than that. But that was really great advice, not in the sense of like, kill your dreams and don't do like something massive, but it was like, try it out and get feedback. And it also keeps you from not doing something because you're waiting for the perfect sense of circumstances.
Yeah. I think that's great advice.
I think for me, it's like, I have a couple rules that I set up for myself, and I figured out this early on. It's like really helpful to just have parameters on how I want to operate and how I want to use my time and my resources. And I think a lot of people kind of reach for a certain like occupation, or they have like role models they try to be, or other people tell them how they should be. But I think it's just like set rules for yourself. My own are things like, you know, don't work for money, work for people that are really cool, do things that I'm really interested in. Money's not important, and just like, be interested in things you do. Like the way that I spend my money, it's like I've said, I don't care what I do as long as if I spend money on tools or education, like that's totally cool. Everything else is like doesn't matter. So that's, I kind of just think like yeah, just don't like try to be something like, oh, I want to say exactly, I want to be like a chef, or I want to be an architect or astronaut or whatever, but just like these are kind of like the parameters by which you set your life, like set an underlying kind of philosophy for how you want to operate, and then just like always every decision you make, look back at that and make sure that's like you're doing the thing that leads you to where you know you could be, and then you'll end up somewhere really interesting, I think.
And then the actually I'm gonna take a song if you guys have a song or song request that I can play to lead into the next thing, then I'll take that now, and then I have a question for you.
Oh, song request. Mm. That's hard for me.
Yeah.
I'm not really like a I'm
is there
not
a
DJ.
Morning song that you like to listen to?
I mean, this morning
is there an excerpt that I can play?
I listened to this morning. I listened to Fela Kuti, Confusion. That was really nice.
Yeah.
Pump myself up. So.
The Nigerian singer?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I thought it was pronounced Fela.
Oh, but perhaps it is.
Maybe I've been saying it wrong this whole time. the question we ask everybody, and I know that it's going to be, especially for you, Jimmy, a tough one to answer, but we ask our guests how you earned your first dollar. Mm-hmm. And think about, I guess, this in context. Like, how did you, I guess, earn your first dollar was in a way that made you feel that that is the position you wanted to be in life. Like you were doing something that gave you the fulfillment that you desire and you stuck to your rules, mm-hmm. and it gave you back something that enabled you to continue. Mm-hmm. Because money is important at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So how'd you earn your first dollar?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm like totally differentiate from Jimmy on this. I'm like all about the money. And I started working really young. I did like voice acting as a kid. Then I worked in a bakery when I was like definitely underage. And then I started a babysitting hustle when I was 12.
Wow.
I think that money is really important and being valued for your, I mean, I'm anti-capitalist, but yes. I also believe that like this is the currency by which we like in this society, honor one another's labor. But the first dollar that I really remember earning in like a meaningful way, that's a tougher one. I just like definitely was always trying to make money as a kid and had like, I would make jewelry and sell it. Oh, you know what I used to do? I used to buy Harry Potter scarves, like Gryffindor and Slytherin here in Chinatown, and go to my middle school and upsell them.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And,
like $5 up on every scarf.
No idea.
During like Harry Potter years.
Yeah. Oh. Amazing.
Ever.
I don't know if that's like really.
I like that hustle. That's like a really good hustle.
Where'd you get the capital for this?
I also sold like beaded rings that I made for a dollar.
Oh.
I had like a lot of middle school hallway hustles for sure. Thinking back on
that's
it.
No
you
idea.
Like opened up your jacket and then we're just like, that's incredible.
Jimmy?
I think for me, my first meaningful dollar was I was doing other people's homework for money. And so it was usually like...
We've had a few of those.
Yeah.
Really?
It's been a bit of a pattern. Yeah.
And so I had a really good pricing model.
Your booking.
About our guests. About creative people in general.
Yeah, just hustle. I would charge 50 cents per point. So like I could make up to $50 per project that I worked on. And for me, it just allowed me to do more of the things that I was interested in. So at that time, it was computer science. And so I was like, oh, I'll do your project and my project and all these other people's projects and make a quick buck so I can buy more hamburgers and like eat more food. Yeah.
Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for being here.